Welcome back to the NBA Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. It has been a bit. I've been quite sick, but I'm back in action now and really happy to have back for my return to the podcasting stage, as it were, Rowan, back for another episode here to talk about his most recent article on Isaiah Collier. So, Rowan, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
Doing great. Hungry, but hungry to podcast and dig in on some Collier work. Yeah.
So why don't we get started with this? And Collier is someone who I really was glad that you wrote about for multiple reasons, but because he's someone who I think you and I have had higher than a lot of the No Ceilings team for a lot of the season. I think I was maybe the second slowest to drop him out of the top 10 sort of at the start of the season. And now that he's sort of getting back in the swing of things after his return from injury, certainly I've been reevaluating, potentially boosting him back up my board. But he's someone who's had an interesting season for a team that has struggled mightily, and certainly more mightily than anybody expected. But I'm curious, what was it that sort of made you decide to write about Collier for this piece at this point in the season?
Yeah, as you alluded to, both of us were long-term holdouts for his stock. I think that when I was looking for prospects that were really catching my eye in the short term, right around the time that I had finished up writing about Castle, Collier started to get in a really nice rhythm. And it wasn't just about following a hot streak. It was more noticing how he was coming back from his injury and that he was starting to look like the kind of guy that I had put higher on my board for, in my mind, good reason, and starting to fulfill a lot of the upside and just present day talent level that I'd expected from him coming into the season.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And you sort of mentioned this at times throughout the piece, and we'll certainly get into it in more detail later. But for someone like Collier, who has pretty clearly defined strengths and weaknesses, but also has the upside to be, as you called him, the demigod of mythology that he was in high school, you know, it's something where, especially in this class, I think that's, you know, part of the reason, you know, I can only speak for myself here, but part of the reason why I was slower to drop him out of the top crew is because the point guard crop in this class isn't quite as deep as it's been in recent years. And the sort of superstar upside is limited. I mean, the latest brouhaha over on draft Twitter is, you know, the concept of Reed Sheppard potentially going number one when people don't see him as potentially having a superstar upside. But, you know, there's something to be said, certainly, for this class's relative lack of strength at the top. But when you're talking about someone who has shown before that he can be the top player in this sort of crew, Isaiah Collier is one of the few players who has that pedigree of proven, you know, top flight superstar level success.
Yeah, watching him in the offseason to start to get that first board ready, there's so much that jumped out about him, even while noticing parts of his game he still could really improve upon, that just stood out as potential star indicators. The way he can get downhill, just his general, like, upper and lower body strength. For a guy who's that young, who'll be coming in as a true freshman, it shows, and it's something that he not only like used to a heavy advantage in high school, but has helped him at USC to navigate the stormy and tumultuous season that he's had. I think that whenever you get a player who is really athletically talented, has a lot they bring to the table, and has a jump shot that they're still working on, it's worth considering whether they'll be able to overcome in this era that kind of deficiency in their game. We've seen guys rebuild their shots. We've seen them improve just enough. And I don't think Collier fits into it, but there's a certain tier of players. Even if they don't develop the most reliable jump shot, they have enough of the other elite traits that they can get there. I don't think Collier totally falls into that bucket. It isn't out of the question for him if he hits one of his like top outcomes to get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I know that I'm much higher on Dylan Mitchell than the rest of the collective, but I think there's a wide gap between the Dylan Mitchell level of broken jump shot and the Isaiah Collier level, where it's not a weapon for him by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly an area that needs improvement. But I mean, you know, he is hitting, you know, 33% on three attempts per game, right? It's not like he's Rajon Rondo level of refusing to shoot at all times as a point guard. You know, it's something that's an element of his game. And certainly, as we'll get into in just a moment, you know, when you talk about the strengths of his game, it's the kind of thing where, especially, you know, in a league where teams really need guys who can pressure the basket, who can attack downhill, create openings for their teammates, those are areas where Isaiah Collier really excels. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, maybe the discussion around his draft stock, I mean, certainly the draft discussion around his draft stock would be very different if he was playing on a different squad that played better to his strengths. I mean, as you say in the piece, right, you know, there are other people who bear the brunt of the sort of struggles that USC has had this season, right? It's not that Isaiah Collier has bombed out and that's the only reason that they haven't quite lived up to expectations.
Yeah, I track all the games that I've watched this year, like, in entirety. USC games are still one of the teams I've watched the most, so I've had that up close and personal view of the wheels falling off in at times slow motion. Other times, it looks like it's fast forward, and it's a bummer. There's no two ways around it. This team had a lot of hype, and it was deserved. They brought back a lot of returning players who I wouldn't say were potentially on the radar for NBA teams, but were great college players who filled clear roles. They supplemented that by getting both Collier and Bronny James, who are legitimate guard prospects. Altogether, Andy Enfield's done a great job as coach up until this point, too, on the recruiting and just the on-floor product. And due to injuries, due to shooting slumps, due to a whole range of things, parts of which are on Collier, it just has been, maybe outside of West Virginia, one of the more bummer college basketball teams. And it's just something that happens during a season. You can project as much as you want in the off season. Once the ball hits the hardwood, that's when it will actually turn out to be a win, a loss, or a season that went down the drain in this way.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue, you know, West Virginia is definitely a good shot, but you could argue that the other team that's been the most disappointing in the country this season has been their Los Angeles City mates, right, in UCLA. It's the kind of thing where, you know, sometimes these things just don't quite work out as planned. And, you know, it's, again, the kind of thing where, as we'll get into in a minute, as you mentioned, some of the worst defensive rebounding and three-point percentage in the country, not exactly a good fit for what Collier does well, but speaking of which, let's start getting into, you know, the stuff that he does well. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, when you're talking about his ability to drive downhill and attack the basket, you know, any sort of numbers you can look at, he's going to shine as one of the better players in the country. I mean, just the most basic stuff, right? Nearly 9 2-point attempts per game, hitting 54% of them, you know, great mark for a guard. As you mentioned in the piece, 151 attempts at the rim, shooting just under 62% is, you know, it's not quite like DeAndre Jordan level, right? But it's pretty spectacular for a guard who, you know, is contested on the vast majority of those looks, right? It's not like he's just throwing down open dunks at a 62% rate. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where, again, if the shooting around him was better, maybe those numbers look better. And maybe, you know, we're still talking about him as a top 10 guy rather than someone who's sort of fallen off that kind of pedestal. But, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, once you sort of take a look at just how quick his burst is and how easily he gets around other players, you know, not to mention the fact that he's already got good size. I mean, for like a 19-year-old point guard, he's got fantastic bulk already. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, I've talked to the point where people, I'm sure, are sick of it about, you know, watching early career De'Aaron Fox and how he weighed about 4 pounds and, you know, his ankles were about as big around as my pinky finger, and it made it very easy to sort of push him off his spot. And for someone who relied on his speed as much as De'Aaron Fox did, and, you know, to lesser extent still does now, but for someone who relies on that burst so much, if you get all the way to the rim and you can't finish through people, you know, it's the kind of thing that I actually talked about with Tyler Metcalf earlier this season when we were talking about AJ Johnson, right? It's like, okay, you know, you can attack the basket all you want, you know, you can have the sort of aggressiveness that you would want to see from someone, but if you weigh 160 pounds and you're getting shoved around at the basket, there's only so much you can do. That is the that is far from the problem that Isaiah Collier has ever had and will ever have. I mean, he's got an NBA ready body already, which is not something that you often see for a teenage point guard.
He's going to come in with that strength, and he's also just gosh dang fast. There are so many times that whether it's in the half court, the first or second step, just being able to get past that defender who is trying to hedge, who's coming up in like a higher drop, Collier just goes by guys. He can absorb the contact if he even needs to absorb it. There are a lot of times that what would tend to be a more contested layup, he's getting there. And these are layups. He's at six dunks. He's hit all six of his attempts for that on the season, but he's using a finishing package with his strength and his speed that it looks like it will translate in my eyes. There are finishes where he's using both hands. There are times where he hits up and unders that take ridiculous angles before falling back in. And on a lot of these attempts, if he had, as you're saying, Fox's weight, if he had a lot less girth, he really would not be able to finish at the clip that he does. And it's a legitimate weapon. There are other guys that I've looked at, guys like Judah Mintz earlier, where Judah has a great finishing package. He's just not able to take the kind of hits, get to round 10, 12, like a boxer that Collier can do, because Collier is still attacking the rim feverishly late in games. He is still going downhill. He's still trying to get into the post. His post looks haven't either been a big staple in the Trojans offense or something that he can rely upon as a go-to. But you're starting to see the echoes, the first whispers of something that he can deploy once he ages a bit, once he develops little parts of his game. And that comes down to the strength. You see Jalen Brunson will operate out of the post a lot. And obviously he's one of the best guards, if not the best at it. I don't think Collier is projected to get there. He has the skill set where he could. You can't say that about maybe any other guard that's in this class.
And, you know, with Jalen Brunson, I think that's a particularly apt comparison. You know, there's the question of whether Isaiah Collier is 6'5 or more like 6'3. As you mentioned in the article, Jalen Brunson's 6'2, right? If you have that kind of size and can use that leverage, you know, if you're 5'8, maybe that's a different thing. But, I mean, there's sort of a requisite threshold that Collier at least clears when you're talking about, you know, if a 6'2 point guard can be the best point post-up point guard in the league, you know, that size is not necessarily a detraction. I want to stick with the De'Aaron Fox comparison for a moment because I could talk about De'Aaron Fox until I'm blue in the face, but also because I think it ties in very well to something that you mentioned, which I think is key when talking about his attacking. And I'm just going to quote you directly here because I think it's the best way to go about this. These drives come from his raw athletic abilities, but not highlighting his handle would do him a disservice. Collier has a robust bag of tricks that he uses with his dribble, whether it be a quick cross, hesitation, or in-and-out dribble, but what's most important is the pace at which he wields it. He knows when to slow down his dribbling to bait a defender, then speed it up and pound the ball on his way to the rim. That, I think, is the most underrated skill of rim-attacking point guards, is the ability to switch up speeds. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where I think it's easier to see in someone like a James Harden or a Luka Doncic who, you know, they, when P3 did their deceleration metrics, James Harden, I don't remember the exact percentiles, but James Harden and Luka Doncic were like ridiculously high up there, like 90th, 95th percentile. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, again, it's also easy to see with someone like, say, Nikola Jokic, right? Where, you know, if you have three gears, you know, being able to switch between them fluidly, it's not that big of a deal if you're switching between fast, medium, and slow versus slow, slower, and slowest, right? It's throwing defenders off. It's, you know, that little hesitation that makes the defender think you're going one way, you know, the hang dribble that makes them think you're going to attack just a split second earlier than you actually do. You know, with De'Aaron Fox, it was the kind of thing where coming into the league, it wasn't just the size concern. It was that he was trying to go 100 miles an hour all the time. And even if you're the fastest player in the league, if you're trying to go top speed all the time, you know, defenders can take a step back, you know, give you a little bit more room and then sort of have the ability to adjust because they know exactly the speed you're attacking at. Guess what? It's the same speed you always attack at. It's the kind of thing where the vast majority of drive first point guards figure that out, you know, year two, year three, year four in the NBA. And it goes back to the body conversation with Collier, right? Where it's like, he's got this NBA ready skill already. And it's the kind of thing that some guys who struggle at the NBA to attack the basket successfully never quite figure out. And for him to have that before he even gets into the league, it's a very good sign for me anyway, that he'll be able to continue to attack the rim successfully once he gets to the NBA as well.
All the indicators of just little skills, as you're talking about, they're leading to what he'll be able to do at the NBA. They are positive with the handle. He takes a lot of mid-range shots that he creates on his own, not hitting a lot. He can create those pretty easily as that like counterpunch to getting to the rim. 6 free throw attempts per game. Again, could he stand to hit more? Yes. It's a pretty great foundation to be getting to the line with that aggressiveness, because he could be absorbing a lot of the contact, and either whether it's make or miss, it's a mark of a guy who's a star who's going to be able to get easier points. Yeah, I think with Collier, even if he doesn't end up, which he probably won't, depending on the situation, being given a lot of chances to work through the kinks of being a primary creator, there are potentials to have those minutes in pockets. And if he keeps developing, there's not a lot of reason that I see that he couldn't start to use that driving as a bit of a game-breaking advantage mechanism for a team. That would be his first foray into demanding and deserving more possessions to start to get to that, not just NBA level, but higher NBA level skill with his drives. It comes from his handle, it comes from his speed, but not every fast guy is going to put a guy on his back, try and get that contact, and then bait the defender to come up, get around him. That takes the same kind of point guard brain that he has, and that was a really big reason that looking at him, he was a very complete package other than some faults as a point guard prospect.
So speaking of the point guard brain, let's get into the passing. And this, I think, is a very important facet of this, because ultimately, you know, again, if you're a point guard who's relying upon, you know, driving the lane, collapsing the defense, being able to kick out to open shooters is a huge part of being able to take full advantage of those driving gifts. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, there we've seen, you know, players who had worse sort of situations in this regard. But ultimately with Collier, you know, it's asinine to say this, but if you make the perfect kickout pass, you know, nobody's going to remember it if the guy doesn't hit the shot afterwards, right? And it's the kind of thing where, you know, again, maybe Collier's stock looks a bit better if the guys around him are hitting more shots. If Kobe Johnson clears, you know, someone else who I know we were both high on heading into the year, you know, if Kobe Johnson clears 30% for 3-point range, you know, maybe we're talking about a different discussion. Defenses can't quite key in on him as much. The good news for Collier, you know, on the flip side is, you know, wherever he ends up, I think it's pretty clear at this point, he's not exactly going to be the number one pick in the draft, right? So it's like he's going to a team that almost certainly, barring like severe injury, severe weirdness, or some GM buying into him a lot more than others, you know, he's not going to be the primary guy. The flip side of that, of course, is that though the passing lanes will be a lot more open than they were at USC because teams are keying in on other guys rather than him. And, you know, that's the kind of thing where, you know, and we'll get into the sort of six-man discussion later in the article, but it's the kind of thing where when he has the ball in his hands, he's at his most effective. And so then the question is, okay, when is it most effective for him to have the ball in his hands? And if it's the kind of thing where, you know, maybe he's playing 15 minutes a game, but he's the primary ball handler for a team, he might look a lot better than if a team decides, you know what, we think of you as an off guard, like, I guess attack when you have the opening, but we want to work on your shot. You know, that's maybe a thing where you question the decision making of the front office slash coach. But, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where there are a lot of players, you know, not to be unkind, but the most obvious one in the last few years, Drew Timmy, right? Of like, okay, it's very clear why your game works at the college level. Once it gets to the pro level, it's not going to function in quite the same level. With Collier, you know, and it's weird to say this about someone who's, you know, been the star for a pretty high profile team, but, you know, you could argue, certainly, and I would argue that he, you know, will be better served by playing in an NBA environment where he's not the focus. That opens up a lot more of his game rather than, oh no, he doesn't have the ball in his hands, can he do anything useful?
I agree with all that. It sounds in some ways counterintuitive to say that, but you wouldn't give someone like him as much usage as he has but you also wouldn't give him as many touches if you didn't expect him to be helping out the rest of his team. Even though he was the number one recruit in the country by a lot of different ranking systems, Boogie Ellis was a guy who was expected to come in and be the Trojans' leading scorer. He's a veteran guard. He is a sniper, and Collier does his best and does it really well to find him in great spots. He's already fitting into that team concept where, yeah, he has a above 30 usage. He has an above 30 assist percentage, too. Yeah. That's a pretty narrow band of players. It's a funky and fascinating band of players, but the only guys who can fit in there are ones who it's good when they are dominating the ball every now and then. He's not just dominating it for him to get his. He's getting, you know, his former high school teammate. He's getting all of his new players that he's next to. He's trying to set everyone up in their spots and hitting them in the best potential way for them to make a positive impact. It's high usage, but it's high usage that is meant to serve winning basketball.
Yeah, you mentioned the 30% usage, 30% assist percentage. And so before we move on to the next section, I do just want to go over this Bartorvik query that you put in the piece. So, you know, when you're talking about a category that is former Sacramento Kings legend Tyreke Evans, one of the weirdest draft stories we have ever and will ever see in Markelle Fultz, and All-NBA, All-Star, led his team to a conference finals in year three, Trae Young, that's a pretty good list. Even if you're at the bottom of that list, pretty clearly, that's a very good list to be on. And, you know, it's, as you mentioned, right, it's the kind of thing where, okay, he's someone who's clearly shown the ability to be an impact player, both with his scoring and his passing. And, you know, especially when we get into the next section, when we're sort of talking about the potential holes in his game, it's the kind of thing where, you know, this is true of basically every player ever, except, like, I'm struggling to even think of an example of someone who it's not true for, where the fit is everything. But it's the kind of thing where, you know, for Collier, I think it's even more important than it might be for someone like, say, a Cody Williams, right, whose, you know, arguably greatest weakness is his relative lack of offensive aggressiveness, right? It's like, okay, but he'll be a secondary playmaker. You know, he has defensive struggles. I struggle with Cody Williams' screen navigation, I think, a lot more than many people do. But, you know, the concept behind him is, okay, this is someone who, you know, strip away context, he can fit basically everywhere. You know, that was a lot of the argument for Brandon Miller last year, right? It's like, okay, basically wherever you put him, he's going to find a way to maximize his skill set. And, you know, if he goes to a team that needs more on-ball creation, he'll have the ball in his hands more, given that he went to Charlotte, who, you know, when healthy, they have LaMelo Ball, you know, okay, he's probably more of an off-ball shooting type, right? But the exceptions kind of prove the rule in that regard, right? Of you have to be an exceptionally well-rounded prospect to be someone where the fit isn't everything, right? But for Collier, it's the kind of thing where, you know, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, right? It's like, okay, but the fit at USC has been pretty poor for him, right? And given that he's done what he's done with that kind of surrounding context, where, as you mentioned, basically the only real shooting threat is essentially Boogie Ellis, is like, you're going to hopefully get a lot more help on that front at the NBA level. And maybe some of the problem areas look a bit brighter when you're surrounded by a better context.
It's almost entertaining to look back at some of the finalists Collier had as well, of UCLA, Michigan, and Cincinnati, given we talked about UCLA having some issues. Michigan has had more issues. Alma mater's really stepping on the rake and then lighting themselves on fire in that way. And I don't think it represents anything other than a really distinct example of that context you're talking about. There are reasons that Collier had all of those teams as finalists. There are reasons he is still on many, and should be on many, first-round draft boards. It's going to take the team that decides to focus on strength and not detract him for his weaknesses to then get him into a role where he's going to succeed. Fultz is his own can of worms that no one could have predicted, because watching Fultz at Washington was picturesque. The things he did were either jaw-dropping or he made what should have been hard easier. Same with Trae Young, same with Tyreke Evans. At times, same with Collier. He can just go another gear past guys that you just don't see every day. He can run an offense in a way that you wish the point guard of your team could. Those flashes are fewer and far between and are going to need a more direct and probably more patient plan. But the fact that he's within even just shouting distance of guys like that shows that there probably is a context where he can succeed. Who's to say even to that level? It's a pretty narrow band, but it exists.
Let's get into the weaknesses now. And the sort of headline weakness is one that, you know, the good news is that it's been better recently. You know, that's, I think, important to mention. But improving to 3.2 turnovers a game is not something you want to see from your lead point guard. So let's at least get into that sort of concern. And, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where, you know, we can talk about how, you know, he's a really great passer who's, you know, does a great job of spraying the ball around. The problem is, you know, he's also spraying the ball into the stands sometimes. And, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, some of it is, you know, offensive fouls, which is the kind of thing where pretty much everybody, you know, I mean, Maxwell talked about this earlier in the season with a lot of the, you know, offensive foul turnovers that Mattis Buzelis was having of, you know, it's the kind of thing that a lot of young players struggle with, right? It's not a particularly surprising thing, but the flip side of that, you know, as we'll get into later on, when you talk about someone with Collier's other holes in his game, he needs to be a lot closer to what you mentioned with Markelle Fultz of being, you know, more of a picture perfect point guard prospect to sort of make up for the other deficits in his game. And, you know, again, I don't want to belabor the point. He's been better about it recently, but I mean, when you start the season with 17 turnovers in your first three games, you know, it's all uphill from there pretty much. But, you know, again, it's especially given the, you know, strengths and weaknesses of his game, he really does need to do a better job of holding on to the ball to be able to maximize the rest of his skill set.
Yeah, it's not easy to sugarcoat if you're drafting a point guard, having a lot of skepticism towards one who turns it over in the way he does. Yeah, it's great. 2.5 turnovers in conference play. It's, as you've said, you kind of could only go up from where he started. In tracking a lot of the turnovers he had, there isn't a consistent theme, which is both, it's not like he has one glaring weakness that he's really going to have to shore up. The offensive fouls, the going 100 miles an hour and going for the hero pass, at times he would get stripped because he is driving into a bigger crowd. Those all have different root causes. The offensive foul problem, he is really strong, learning how to best use his strength. I didn't expect him to do it at 19. It's still a little more than I expected for him. And I think defenses realize that they can start to use his advantage to theirs. If they were going to flop every now and then, if they're going to absorb that contact, they're going to get calls enough. And those turnovers for how USC was, they really matter in that span of the game. For spraying passes around, he would hit a lot more of those difficult through needle in a haystack windows that you don't see many guys do. When you try those, you are going to throw them out of bounds. You are going to be a little off accuracy wise with the pace he's putting on. And with the handle itself, getting stripped like that when you have another guy coming down on you, it makes sense when the rest of your team is currently shooting in a way that does not demand respect. Having a clogged paint is not surprising and leads to those sorts of turnovers. That's not to take sort of the responsibility away from Collier, but I at least came out a bit more bullish by the fact that it wasn't about his accuracy or it wasn't about a issue with his handle. There are places that he's slowly cleaning up. It would be great to see a squeaky clean finish in the Pac-12 tournament. I don't think they're getting farther than that. So that's in some ways before it gets into workout and combine season, his last audition to show what he's become and the incremental changes he's made in season to adjust to what it's like at the college game for his ball control.
I sort of put those three areas into three different buckets. Let's just go with the first one because it's the easiest. The offensive foul stuff is just, he just needs to clean that up. That's, yeah, there's not much more I can say beyond that. The passing turnovers are interesting to me because that's the kind of thing where I think there's pluses and minuses to it. Like, it's good for him to have the audacity to try some of those passes. It speaks well to his ability to, you know, find openings that other guys don't, to, you know, hit those windows in a way that if he's a half second earlier or a half second later, you know, it's a turnover. But if he gets it just right, it's, you know, a window through the defense that nobody's going to be able to stop, right? It's the kind of thing where live passing turnovers, especially if, you know, they're more just due to trying things, especially at the college or, you know, non-NBA level, it's the kind of thing where I think there's actually an underlying positive there that, you know, yes, it needs some cleaning up, right? You know, that's, I don't think, you know, too unfair to say, but, you know, there's an element to which there's an underlying positive of, okay, at least he's trying these things. The getting stripped is a kind of thing where, you know, again, okay, you know, everybody could serve to clean that up a little bit, sure. But as you mentioned, like, being sort of forced to drive into crowds to create things when, you know, nobody else is helping you out with spacing all that much is the kind of thing where, again, in a different context, I think that looks a lot better. So, you know, of those three, one of them is just a clear, okay, you need to work on this. One of them, I think it's strengths and weaknesses. And the other is, you know, maybe this is a weakness. Maybe this is just the context that's making it incredibly difficult for him to succeed, no matter how tight of a handle he keeps on the ball.
Yeah. In the passing vein, I don't know if I included as many as I saw in the article, but in looking through as many, if not all, of Collier's turnovers they could, I could probably get about a dozen where a guy cut into space or was pretty wide open. Collier made the read, and it wasn't his fault that he got that like live ball passing turnover. I think that obviously not everybody in the world can look at every pass, turnover, or assist, but looking into the nitty-gritty of where he's turning it over, I think that the offensive fouls more than the other two, as you're saying, are something he'll want to clean up, because defenses are only getting smarter. They only get better at the next level. If we're noticing that as something for him to clean up, you can bet a good amount of money that teams will also want to exploit that. And so he's going to have to adjust his game for it to not be a consistent thorn in the side.
Let's get into the shooting. We've, you know, sort of tease it throughout, but, you know, this is where I think we really need to dig in. And, you know, as you mentioned, the actual swing skill is the shooting more so than the turnovers. You know, the turnovers, as we just discussed, right, there's serious areas where it needs to clean up, but there's a mixed bag element to it, right? The shooting is just, you know, again, it's the swing skill for so many prospects, so it's not particularly surprising. But, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, 107 jump shots per synergy, shooting 33.6%, which it's gross. And, you know, the other thing that you mentioned, I've said before on this podcast many, many a time that I think of myself as a partial free throw truther, in that there's a lot of indication of touch that you see in free throw numbers that, especially given how much smaller the sample size is of 3-point shots for virtually every single college player, you know, you get a really good indication of touch from free throw shooting that you don't necessarily get from 3-point numbers. I mean, I've said it before and it feels mean, but I think it's indicative of what I call the Derek Williams principle of, you know, okay, you go like, you know, 50% on like 35 3-point attempts, or I think it was actually 70, but, you know, on a pretty small volume of attempts. And all of a sudden everybody's like, oh, you know, he's this absolute shooting threat who's also this athletic menace. And he gets to the NBA and he's sub 30% from three most of his career. It's like, okay, you know, maybe if you'd seen that he was struggling from the line to a much greater extent than he was getting lucky on 3-pointers, that's the kind of thing that shines through. So with Collier, I mean, we mentioned it in the plus section, right, of how NBA ready his body is, how willing he is to attack the basket, get to the line. He needs to hit at higher than 67.8%. And, you know, there's the one element where, you know, sort of insulting with faint praise here of like, okay, at least he's still willing to attack the basket despite the fact that he's struggling as a free throw shooter. You know, not to name names, but cough, Ben Simmons, cough, cough. There are guys who, you know, struggle to hit their free throws and then just, you know, avoid the free throw line at all costs. I mean, you know, I think maybe this is before some of our listeners' times, but Andres Biedrinch's career essentially ended because he couldn't hit a free throw to save his life. It was like 16%, and all of a sudden he was out of the league pretty quickly after that, right? It's like, we're not talking about that kind of level, right? But the flip side is attacking the basket is a lot more important part of Isaiah Collier's game than it was of Andres Biedrinch's game. You know, Ben Simmons is a different matter entirely for so many different reasons. But, you know, as you mentioned, there's, you know, the struggle across all jump shots, but also the pull-up shots, as you mentioned, you know, there's sort of the mechanical stuff of him not always getting his feet under him. But, you know, even beyond the mechanical stuff, you can just look at the raw numbers and say, okay, 37% on pull-up twos and 27% on a pull-up threes is not where it needs to be. And it's the kind of thing where I think this is a lot of what will determine, you know, I can make the sort of joke about, you know, no ceilings, we don't want to talk about guys' ceilings, ha ha ha, whatever. But, you know, the idea here being that, okay, you know, if you're just a rim attacking point guard who, you know, can't do anything once you're forced away from the basket, you know, there's a difference between the discussions that, you know, we had around Jaden Ivey of, okay, you know, he's someone who's great around the basket, who his freshman season really struggled with his 3-point shot. By his sophomore year, that been, you know, turned around. NBA career been inconsistent from the 3-point line, but it's been there, right? It's the kind of thing where, okay, he just needs to unlock that mid-range area of his game to open up everything else, right? With him, it's like, okay, he's a 2-level scorer. Can he get to the third that he needs to be a superstar? For Collier, it's more like, all right, he's got the at-rim stuff. And for him to not be, you know, again, I use this as an example because it's easy for me to pull off the top of my head, right? The Rajon Rondo of just getting absolutely abandoned at the 3-point line, right? It's like, okay, you know, even if you're taking a couple of threes a game like Collier has been, you know, again, 33% doesn't look as bad when you're just looking at the raw 3-point percentage number. When you look at 27% on the pull-ups and you look at 33.7% across all jump shots, it's the kind of thing where, okay, where are we at with what he can do as a shooter, period? And as you mentioned, you know, he needs a reliable jumper as a guard who is, you know, as you say, probably closer to 6'3 than 6'5, but more to the point, like, you need to be in, you know, the 6'6 plus range to have that lack of a jumper not particularly be an issue, because you need to be able to exploit defenses who are going under against you. And if Collier can't do that, then again, we're talking about someone who, you know, is much more likely to be an end of the bench role player than someone who's going to be a significant contributor for a team.
It sounds like a broken record in some ways. The context is so important. His personal context of being such a good finisher and really having no changeup is what makes it, in some way, like a frustrating watch. He's not shy about trying to work his way through this weakness. Do I think it's always the best idea for him to try that in a close game? Probably not. He's not going to suffer from the sample size concerns you mentioned with Derek Williams. At this juncture in the NBA's ecosystem, not being able to pull up as a guard, you better have everything else.
Yeah.
Collier doesn't. Collier has turnover issues. Collier has defensive qualms. He can create for himself, but if he's not hitting the shots he's creating, then it loses a lot of its luster and its appeal in that way. As I come back to every now and then during this podcast, he was injured. He missed time in the games after that against Washington State, against Washington, against Arizona. He's looking better. Can we trust that small sample size compared to what he had shown before? I think that there are parts of USC that have improved team context-wise around him, but for a 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", guard who's going to, ideally for his role, have the ball for majority of possessions, it's going to put a cap on what that team can get out of their offense if they can't rely on him to create his own shot anywhere but 2 feet from the basket. It is a bit of an interesting wrinkle that his catch and shoot looks the best for him. In some ways, that's a bit of an Occam's razor conclusion. When a guy doesn't have to worry about getting their feet under them, stopping on a dime outside of just like finishing above them, when they can step in and hit a shot in rhythm, it does look cleaner. His mechanics look more consistent. He's hitting 36.4% of his threes. Nowhere close to an elite catch and shooter in that way, but it's looking better for Collier. I just wish he wouldn't take them as deep as he does. That part confused me. I know he might be trying to get NBA range. That was farther than NBA range for a whole host of his shots, make or miss.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the catch and shoot stuff is actually very important for him, just purely because it's the idea of, okay, you're someone who, you know, pretty much needs the ball in their hands to be successful, but can you do anything when you don't have the ball in your hands? I think that's a very critical question, especially for someone like Collier, who, you know, if the shooting was better, you know, in theory, you could say, okay, but, you know, he's at least got the bulk to potentially be a second guard, but he can't be that second guard if, you know, all he can do is things with the ball in his hands. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, okay, the, you know, catch and shoot stuff, it's very helpful, but the fact that he basically doesn't cut at all, he has 5 cuts all season per synergy. It's, you know, the kind of thing where there's an element of, okay, he's always got the ball in his hands, so he's not going to cut as much as some other guys, but there's a difference between not as much as some other guys and literally 5 times all season, right? So, you know, on the one hand, it's like, okay, the catch and shoot thing actually, you know, for an area of his shooting game, you know, it's not the first thing you think of for a guy who's got the ball in his hands, but it's a very helpful thing for him to theoretically earn minutes in other ways rather than only having the ball in his hands all the time. But, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where, given his, you know, lack of threat as a pull-up shooter and given just the complete absence of cutting from his game, it's the kind of thing where he'd need to be, I would argue, he'd need to be elite as a catch and shoot guy for teams to even be able to consider him as a potential off-ball guard. And, you know, especially as we'll get into in just a minute with some of the defensive concerns, right? It's the kind of thing where the avenues for him to earn playing time on an NBA roster are significantly cut down if there's nothing that he can really do when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, because the threshold for him to have the ball in his hands all the time is, you know, even if he's going to a different context in the NBA than he would be at USC, the threshold is much higher and he's going to need to clear it.
Whatever context he goes to is going to demand that he pretty quickly improve in that off-ball game. And there's a function of the Trojans offense. He's not running around screens or even like creating a lot off the catch in a way that he gets down to the rim. He will start the possessions with the ball in his hands. He is choosing which path in the choose your own adventure that offensive possession will be. And I get it. He is a stellar point guard and was thought of in that way to have Andy Enfield put the roster around him and to have him fit in that team concept. As we've touched on a number of times, no team is going to give him that right off the jump. When he's out there, he's not going to get every possession for an NBA team. It's going to behoove him to just be taking catch and shoots, to be taking shots off just one dribble when he gets it off of a bent defense. He hasn't shown it, and it's not just about the absence of opportunities that make it something where, oh, he could get better. I would have loved to have seen more to feel confident to be able to say that. I don't feel very confident in him as an off-ball offensive plus for a team. That just makes it such a fine line of where he's going to be successful early in his career. And that early part's going to matter. How much patience will you have with Collier to develop, to heighten his strengths, to shore up his weaknesses? I would love for a team to be patient. It isn't historically proven for a guy that might end up being taken in the mid lottery at highest or lower.
And, you know, when you're talking about that, I think, you know, one of the other areas that needs to be brought up is the defense. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, when we're talking about him earning the developmental minutes that he needs, one of the easiest ways to, you know, get put in a coach's doghouse is to not be the kind of defender that you need to be. And Collier is a fascinating case on that front. I mean, I talked about this at length, mostly with Metcalf a couple of years ago when talking about Kendall Brown and the idea that for someone who showed such exceptional preternatural awareness of cutting and reading the floor on the offensive end, it was just not there at all on the defensive end, almost diametrically opposed. And Collier, it's not as, you know, strong of a case as that by any means, but it's the kind of thing where you would expect him to do better in some of the areas where, you know, his physical profile is a huge plus on the offensive end, right? Like for someone who's as stocky and has as NBA ready of a body as he does to struggle as he does navigating around screens, right? Like I mentioned, you know, my issues with Cody Williams's screen navigation earlier, right? But Cody's got half a foot on Collier and is 20 pounds, maybe more, lighter, right? So it's like, okay, if he's dying on screens, like, it's not good. It's a problem, but I get it, right? With Collier, it's like, for someone who has the foot speed that he shows on the offensive end when he's attacking the basket, and for someone who has the sturdy frame that he does, that he shows when he's, you know, bullying his way through guys near the basket, he's just not showing it at all on the defensive end. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, as you mentioned, he's not a lost cause, right? I mean, there's some positive stuff there. You know, I've talked many times this season and many times since I started doing this podcast many years ago about, you know, this sort of idea that steals rate translates at a very high level between non-NBA leagues and NBA leagues. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, that's certainly a positive given for Collier that he's averaging 1.5 steals per game. You can expect him to, you know, be able to swipe steals at the NBA level as well. The flip side of that, though, is there are different ways that guys go about getting high steals numbers. And sometimes it's, you know, the Matisse Thybulle just preternatural ability to read passing lanes, jump passing lanes, you know, get out in transition. Sometimes it's Tari Eason at LSU being told, look, you're going to be the free safety. You know, you'll get a lot of opportunities to gamble and get steals. And sometimes it's, you know, someone else who you mentioned earlier in the piece as someone who's got some very comparable skills to Isaiah Collier in Russell Westbrook, who, okay, you know, he was at or near the NBA steals per game lead for a long time, but vast majority of that was because he was gambling on every possession. And if you gamble on 10 possessions and two of them are steals going the other way and eight of them are easy layups, that's not a good, you know, that's not a good math equation for your team, even if the stat line says, okay, you know, he got three steals in this game, clearly had a defensive impact. And with Collier, unfortunately, a lot of that turnover generation is him taking gambles that he, A, might not necessarily want to take, but B, and I think more to the point, speaks to, you know, him sort of not quite digging in on defense as much as maybe you would like. And just, you know, the easy way out is unfair, but it's not entirely unfair of like, okay, he's going to swipe. And if he misses, guy gets past him and, oh, well, I guess we're going back on offense now. So it's very interesting to me when someone with the obvious physical strengths that Collier has, you know, his literal strength being one of them, but his foot speed being the major one, for someone who has such a dichotomy on both ends of the floor in that regard, on the one hand, you know, it lends hope to the idea that, again, he's not a lost cause on defense. On the other hand, it makes you wonder why he hasn't figured all that out already.
Parts of it could be the usage he has. Anytime you have higher usage, it can just take away your energy and will. I don't know if I totally buy into that for Collier at this juncture. I think he just gets skewered on too many screens. He's too slow to notice some off-ball actions. He's going to be a point-of-attack defender at basically any NBA lineup he'll be in, just due to size, unless a team goes really small. But then you're matching a smaller lineup in that regard. To die on a screen like that, to not be able to keep a guy in front of you, to not use one of your strength as that key sort of difference maker, guys are still able to go past him and go through him. It's not a rosy outlook. Other prospects that were on-ball creators that had great athletic abilities to get to the hoop, they were able to offset being poor defenders because they're so good at other things. Collier is good at a few things, is improving in a few, and needs a lot of improvement in others. He doesn't have the luxury and the cushion to be this poor of a defender and to expect to be a highly drafted prospect. At this point, he's going to have to fight for the minutes he gets, fight for the draft slot he gets. Defense for a head coach is a really easy way to show you're fighting. There wasn't a guy behind him who was probably going to oust him from his spot. That's going to be the case at the next level. He isn't going to come in anointed as the guy in the way he was at USC, and the rubber's going to really hit the road. He's going to generate some offense. Will that offset the times he scored on the other end? How soon will it offset those times he scored on the end? Does he have the time to offset the times he scored? That's the crux of it for the defense for me.
So let's wrap up by sort of talking about where you leave this with the conclusion on Collier. And this, I think, is a good way of sort of summing up the entirety of the discussion that we've been having. And, you know, the as anyone who's listened to this podcast before slash has listened to the first, you know, 50 odd minutes of this one is well aware, the NBA team that I watch the most is the team from my current hometown, the Sacramento Kings. And it's fascinating because, you know, the Kings don't have a pick in the range where Isaiah Collier is going to go because their first rounder is going to Atlanta. But he is someone who would be such a wonderful addition for a Kings team that outside of De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk really struggles to put pressure on the rim. Their biggest offensive weakness this year has been that they don't have enough guys who can attack downhill and attack the basket. And so for a team like the Kings, who, you know, they have their number one guard in De'Aaron Fox, clearly they have their number two guard in Malik Monk, they have a lot of, you know, complementary players around them. You know, obviously they have Domantas Sabonis as the guy down low. The idea being the Kings are, you know, basically, I mean, the defense is one thing, but other than certainly offensively, they're pretty much a picture perfect fit for what Collier provides. And so it's the kind of thing where if you're just focused on the weaknesses and you think, okay, this is someone who had, you know, this great pedigree coming in, had a disappointing college season for a really disappointing, you know, maybe the headline disappointing team of the college season, you know, you overlook the fact that, okay, but what he actually does at a high level, if you put it in the right context, it looks fantastic. And, you know, it'll be difficult slash impossible for the Kings to, you know, find their way to sort of worm into position to take Collier. But if they did, you know, he's someone who I would love to have on the Kings because of exactly what he does well. And so it's the kind of thing where, you know, there's stuff to be cleaned up. There's certainly holes in his game, but for the right team and in the right context, you know, you're looking at him as someone who could be one of the steals of the later portion of the first round if teams sort of focus in on only the weaknesses and sort of ignore the areas where you can really help your team. And odds are he's not going to be a Sacramento King by next season. But, you know, the Kings are certainly not the only team in the league that could use someone who can provide an attacking the rim punch off the bench. And, you know, if Collier cleans up his weaknesses, he could be more than just end of the bench, you know, sort of change up kind of option. But even if he doesn't, you know, sort of only looking at the weaknesses and dismissing the strengths, it leads to the concept of, okay, but, you know, if he gets into that right context, right, it's like, again, we can talk about context all day long of, you know, that's what's going to determine how these guys do, you know, where their NBA careers go. But with Collier, you know, there are teams that really need what he provides. And the question is, can he do enough to mitigate his weaknesses to allow teams to see that, no, he actually can really provide a boost to a team? And, you know, the Kings are the team that I watch the most, so it's easiest for me to see, but they are far from the only team in the league that could use someone with his skill set.
If one of those teams is willing to be patient, put that plan in place, they really could reap those benefits with Collier. When you are a playoff team, as I know a lot of picks have been traded, usually in the later range, you need to not only be able to hit on the margins to shore up your fifth, sixth, seventh, or eighth guy, being able to get a cheaper player who then exceeds those expectations and provides more utility for where you drafted him is what's going to separate it from staying the sixth seed forever to having some years where you can push towards the top. Collier is an unfinished product. Maybe when he's finished, he'll have the strengths where he can swing enough games in the regular, maybe even the playoff situations, to make it really worthwhile. There was a reason he was talked about as a star before. Those flashes really bright, hurt your eyes when they're on the screen. The sort of negative plays, they make you want to look away. But there aren't many guys, especially in a draft that it's harder to find like a very clear star that you'd want to tank for. I think part of that is due to last year having that sell the farm, sell the house, sell your shirt to get Wembanyama. There are guys that are going to be stars from this class based on historical precedent, based on development you never see coming. You so rarely get a draft class without guys who earn their keep and earn all-star or all-NBA selections. It probably won't be Collier. It could be. And a team that is willing to play to his strengths, might be there to reap the benefits and see their entire ceiling change in 2 or 3 years once he hits a stride.
Yeah, and, you know, again, talking about the Kings at length, it's the kind of thing where, you know, Kings fans have seen firsthand how badly it can go wrong if you're gambling on the 99th percentile outcome for a player every time and ignoring the 50th percentile outcome. The flip side of that is, you know, especially in this year's class, but in any draft class, right? If you completely ignore the 99th percentile outcome, you know, then you're sort of glossing over the fact that, no, players actually can and do frequently fill in for their weaknesses and, you know, development. This, you know, one of the no-ceilings catchphrases, right? Development isn't linear. It's the kind of thing where, okay, you know, for some guys, they have a sophomore slump, right? Maybe for Isaiah Collier, it's, you know, similar to, I mean, Jaden Ivey's the obvious pull just because he went from, you know, potentially end of the first round consideration coming back for his sophomore year and, you know, being the number 5 overall pick, right? It's, I don't think that the odds of Collier going back to school are anywhere near as high as Jaden Ivey, because guess what? Jaden Ivey was going back to a much better team than Isaiah Collier would be going back to. But, you know, the idea being, if this year is the off year, right? It's like, okay, he was the number 1 recruit in high school. He had a bad year. It was a terrible situation. He didn't have help in the areas where he needed help. And that really exposed the weaknesses in his game. You know, it's the kind of thing where, okay, you know, maybe that's sort of pie in the sky thinking of, okay, what's he going to be at his absolute peak? The flip side is, if you're a team in that 6-seed range, as you mentioned, right? A lot of those teams, you know, they need role players that can, you know, sort of fill holes, fill gaps, make the team more well-rounded as a whole. But a lot of those teams also need second superstars, right? And unlike a lot of the guys who are going to be taken in that sort of 15 to 30 range of this class, Isaiah Collier has shown before that he can be the kind of superstar that those teams are looking for. So, you know, if you're a team that needs an, you know, attacking point guard who can put pressure on the rim and you can mitigate defensive concerns, great. He can slot in as, you know, 8th, 9th man pretty early on. And as long as he's allowed to play through some of his mistakes, you know, maybe not all of his mistakes, but some of his mistakes, right? Then you get someone who can be a valuable role player. However, if you're a team that really needs that second star and, you know, like, I'm trying to think of a good example off the top of my head. I mean, you know, say, I don't know, a New Orleans who, you know, maybe they don't have a top flight point guard, but they have an elite defense. They have great point guard defenders. They have great guard defenders. They have someone, you know, with size like Dyson Daniels. They have, you know, Jose Alvarado as a, you know, pest who can deal with the quicker point guards. There's a lot of sort of buttressing around him. But, you know, New Orleans maybe doesn't need a second star as much as some teams, given they have both Zion and Brandon Ingram. But, you know, the idea there being, okay, if you can come in and there's a role ready for you as an 8th man, you might have the ceiling to grow into being the superstar that your 99th percentile outcome would indicate in a way that you might not if the situation is, you know, calling for a bit more from Collier than he's, you know, ready to provide at this point in his basketball playing career.
And that's sort of the mystery and the joy of studying the draft. You really don't know what's going to happen. There are different parts of Collier's game that seem to indicate he'll go one way or another. It's going to take his own work, his own improvement at whatever pace it goes, and some amounts of luck for whatever team he lands on, maybe the next team he lands on, or the next iteration of that drafted team. You're talking about Brandon Ingram. Eventually, a team like the Pelicans, other teams could face the reality of a salary cap. You can see development skyrocket with opportunity. A team today that's drafting Collier won't look the same as when Collier becomes who he is as an NBA player. For as much as we can see and know about his game, that great unknown in front of him, it has a star potential. And can't say that about as many guys as you'd hope for in this draft. You can say that about a future for Collier.
All right. Anything else you want to cover here before we wrap this one up?
A final pour one out for the USC, UCLA. What other teams do we touch on seasons that I expected to be better, but the teams that have surprised in their stead have been great too? Last salute for the Trojans.
pour one out for anybody in the city of Los Angeles who's a fan of college basketball. Hey, your NBA teams are pretty good. You can deal. All right. Well, he is Rowan Kent. You can find his work, of course, on NoCeilingsNBA.com, and you can find him on Twitter at Rowan Kent. You can find my work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well, and you can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.